Welcome to Royally Screwed. My name is Chris Shearer, and it's my honor to take you on a tour through some of history's greatest, worst, and bizarre rulers. In this episode, we're returning to the saga of the Julio-Claudian dynasty of Rome. It's finally time to dive into the story of the last emperor of the line, Nero Claudius Caesar Augustus Germanicus. I've been waiting a long time for this, and unfortunately I did screw myself over pretty early on in this show by jumping ahead in the story way back in episode 11 by talking about Nero and the Great Fire of Rome in 64 CE. That information would have fit way better within this episode. Nevertheless, let's talk about Nero and how he ruled over the empire. In the previous Julio-Claudian episode, I went over the life of Nero's mother, Agrippina the Younger. She was one of the great matriarchs of the Julio-Claudians and was basically the driving force behind the early days of Nero's reign. However, Nero eventually started to get annoyed with his mother's presence, especially if you believed the rumors from historical sources saying that his mistress called him something akin to a mama's boy and kept insisting he should hold sole power. So, Nero had Agrippina killed. With her death, Nero would be allowed to take full control of the empire in 59 CE. Like Gaius Germanicus, aka Caligula, two emperors before him, Nero's reign is usually divided into two different time frames: the good, when Agrippina was alive, and the bad, after Agrippina was put to death. We've covered the good, so it's clearly time to start covering the bad. But was it really all bad? I guess it depends on your point of view. Some of it makes for funny historical anecdotes, while others... well, we'll get there when we get there. So without further ado, let's continue the story. We're going back in time in the Roman Empire circa 59 CE during the reign of Nero in the beginning of the end. Nero was now emperor in full, no longer held captive to the more political savvy knowledge and probably better rule of his mother. Okay, yeah, Agrippina was probably not the best mother. There are plenty of stories, which I'm hoping aren't true, of Nero's mother making sexual advances on him in order to keep him subservient to her. However, nothing could now get in the way of Nero getting to do what he wanted to do. And what did Nero want to do? I mean, mostly build things? One of Nero's first major construction projects was a new palace, or rather a massive extension onto his already existing palace. The original imperial palace was built on the Palatine Hill. However, there existed several other buildings within the city that the imperial family had come to own over the years, including gardens and estates. Nero, with his vain desire to live a life of luxury, I mean he was 22 at this point in time and had the power of a god, so go figure, decided that he wanted a single palace that would connect all of the imperial family's estates within the city of Rome. Now, you have to remember that Rome was a much smaller city back then compared to what it is today, because this was a much easier feat back in the day. Still a ridiculous decision, but not as ridiculous as it might sound when thinking of Rome from a modern perspective. Nero called this grand project the Domus Transitoria, meaning the House of Passage. Construction on the Domus Transitoria is believed to have begun around 60 CE. Since it was just connecting existing palaces, Nero would have been able to live in it from day one. He would continue to live there until it was partially destroyed by the Great Fire 4 years later. Nero also built further residences elsewhere in the empire. Given that he was born in the city of Antium in Italy, Nero had a villa built there. The building would go on to also support a theater. A lead pipe, probably for sewage, has also been found under the ruins that bears the name Nero Augustus. Nero also greatly expanded the port in Antium. This included creating an artificial harbor. At Nero's villa in Subiaco, he ordered for the construction of 3 artificial lakes, all complete with waterfalls and bridges. Finally, he also had the village of Nero near Olympia in Greece, where he stayed when the emperor participated in the Olympic Games. We'll get to that, I promise. As I said, the Great Fire would damage the Domus Transitoria in 64 CE. Nero decided to refurbish his palace with a massive renovation that would eventually become its own, somewhat separate palace referred to as the Domus Aurea, the House of Gold. I talked a lot about this back in episode 11, but let's do another quick chat here. The DA was disgustingly lavish by historical definitions, meaning it's an absolute masterpiece of historical architecture to look at today, which I've been lucky enough to do. It was a massive undertaking that Nero himself would not even end up living to see fully built. And after his death, the people of Rome would come to hate the structure, viewing it as the pinnacle of Nero's self-importance and Bacchanalian lifestyle. What I didn't talk about last time with the Domus Aurea was the Colossus. Within the vestibule of Nero's new mansion was a massive golden statue to the emperor. Standing at almost 100 feet tall, 30 meters for metric users, the statue was absolutely unnecessary but completely on brand for Nero's rule, post-Agrippina. After Nero's death, the Emperor Vespasian decided to repurpose the statue, adding a crown shaped like rays of light, thereby making the Colossus into a statue of the god Sol, the Roman god of the sun. The Colossus was also moved to be closer to Vespasian's new architectural masterpiece, a massive amphitheater. Though this theater was originally called the Flavian Amphitheater, named after Vespasian's family, its proximity to the Colossus of Nero would eventually cause the theater to be known by its current name, the Colosseum. We're not entirely sure when the Colossus was taken down. The most common theory is that it was dismantled during the sack of Rome in 410 CE by the Visigoths. However, there's a theory that it lasted longer based on a line of poetry by the English poet Bede. As he wrote sometime in the late 7th or early 8th century, "As long as the Colossus stands, Rome will stand. When the Colossus falls, Rome will fall. When Rome falls, so falls the world." But the Colossus did fall, and so did Rome, but the world's still here, so I guess Bede was wrong. While Nero was emperor, he would have 5 spouses. His first wife was Claudia Octavia, whom he had married just before he became emperor, and she was the daughter of the previous emperor, Claudius. While historians are generally favorable towards Claudia, her marriage to Nero was a complete disaster. Nero was so unhappy with the marriage that his advisors had him find a mistress, who was either Claudia or her father's former slave. Nero also constantly complained about wanting to divorce Claudia in favor of his unofficial mistress, Poppaea Sabina. His advisors told him this was a very bad idea, as his marriage to Claudia Octavia symbolized the stability of the Julio-Claudian dynasty, with Nero representing the Julii and Claudia, obviously the Claudii. However, by 62 CE, Nero no longer had his 2 chief advisors, as one had passed away and the other retired from politics. He divorced Claudia, giving her property that had once belonged to one of Nero's relatives he had put to death. The divorce was on the grounds that Claudia was allegedly sterile, as the pair never had any children. Nero and Poppaea tried to further slander Claudia by insisting she had committed adultery, which, like, funny coming from the guy actively committing adultery. Eventually, after a massive public outcry in favor of Claudia, Nero had his first wife exiled to an island off the western coast of Italy. A few days later, soldiers arrived with orders to execute her. And I won't go into it here, but the execution of Claudia Octavia was absolutely brutal. Like, I can deal with some pretty violent stuff, and even this surprised me. And the absolute kicker is that she was only 22 when she was killed. 12 days after Nero divorced Claudia, he married Poppaea. By this point, she was already pregnant with his child, another reason as to why he felt the need to divorce his first wife. Unfortunately for the couple, the child, a daughter named Claudia Augusta, died after only 4 months. As I mentioned in the last Julio-Claudian episode, Nero bestowed the title of Augusta on his second wife, a title that held a lot of power in the Roman Empire, as it was the feminine version of the title Augustus. Not as many women of the Julio-Claudian dynasty were given that honor as you would think. It would be very easy to paint Poppaea as a terrible historical figure. Most of the Roman sources actually do that. However, the Roman Jewish historian Josephus, who wrote a lot about the time around the reign of Nero, during which he also lived, writes that Poppaea may have actually worshipped the Abrahamic God in some capacity. I'm not saying that's what made her not a bad person, but it certainly is interesting for someone given the title of Augusta. In one of his writings, Poppaea apparently stood at the defense of Jewish priests in Jerusalem when Herod Agrippa, the Tetrarch of Roman Judea, wanted to tear down a wall that blocked a view from his palace. The wall was apparently part of or near the Temple of Jerusalem. On Poppaea's advice, Nero sided with the priests. However, not to paint her too favorably for the ancient Jews of Rome, Poppaea did also secure the promotion of a man named Gessius Florus to procurator of Judea, and his discrimination against the Jewish people would help fan the flames of what would become the first Roman-Jewish war. We'll get to that later. One of the most famous stories of Poppaea revolves around her death, or at least the popular story of her death from ancient historians. In 65 CE, Poppaea was pregnant yet again. Different historians write different stories, but the end result is the same. According to them, Nero, in a fit of rage or some other sort of mental instability, kicked Poppaea so hard in the stomach that it caused both her and the child she was pregnant with to die. However, there's a Greek poem that's been found that seems to imply that Poppaea actually passed away during childbirth, and the baby also did not survive. She was given a massive state funeral and was embalmed, apparently also being buried in the tomb of the Julii family, a massive departure from what was expected of a noblewoman's death at this time. Apparently, Nero also went through a whole year's worth of incense just at Poppaea's funeral alone. Nero's third and final wife was a woman named Statilia Messalina. Very little is known about her history before 65 CE. She was probably from a patrician family, and there may have been a few people elected to consul from her family tree. Sometime towards the end of his marriage to Poppaea, or right afterwards, Messalina became Nero's mistress. However, she was already married to a man named Marcus Julius Vestinus Atticus, who also happened to be one of the consuls in 65. Nero forced Atticus to take his own life, thereby freeing up Messalina to marry him. There's not really much else to say about Messalina after that. She apparently kept a lower profile than either Claudia or Poppaea, which probably saved her head on many occasions. Also, as Nero's final wife, that does mean she ended up outliving the emperor. And after Nero's death, we don't really know what happened to her. She just kinda disappeared into history. Now remember, I said that Nero had 5 spouses, but I only named his 3 wives so far. Yeah, that's because Nero's 2 other spouses were men. And before you possibly get all excited about historical figures being what we now call bisexual or pansexual, maybe you should just listen in. Nero's first husband was a freedman, aka former slave, named Pythagoras. Very little is known about the guy besides the fact that in 64 CE he was married to the emperor. Also by that fact, it means Nero and Pythagoras were married while he was still together with Poppaea. The most widely talked about story with Pythagoras and Nero's wedding, however, is that Nero apparently played the role of the bride. Yeah, because even in ancient Rome, you still needed to hear that expression, "So, which of you is the man and which of you is the woman in the relationship?" So, to easily answer that question, Nero was the woman, I guess. Again, like Messalina, not much else is known about Pythagoras after the couple are married. I'm hoping he got to survive all the craziness. And finally, there's Sporus. Like Pythagoras, nothing is known about Sporus's life before he was taken in under Nero. His name probably wasn't even Sporus, as most historians take it to be a joke pet name Nero used because it was the ancient Greek word for semen. Sporus may have been what the Roman called a puer delicatus, which is to say a young boy slave who is mostly used as a sexual partner. The whole practice is very just every kind of yikes, but it was very common for those types of servants to be owned by the emperors. Anyways, ancient historians say that Nero took a liking to Sporus because he happened to look quite a bit like Poppaea, which further adds to the creepy nature of the relationship. Nero apparently would also call Sporus Poppaea from time to time. Nero married Sporus in either late 66 or 67 CE. Again, he was married to Messalina at this time, and Pythagoras was potentially also still in the picture to some capacity. Unlike with Pythagoras, it's said that Nero took Sporus as his bride. Soon after their marriage, Sporus was castrated. Whenever they appeared in public together, Sporus was made to wear clothing traditionally worn by the wife of the emperor. He was even given a courtier to act as his mistress of the wardrobe, acting as a handmaiden of sort. He remained Nero's husband throughout the rest of the emperor's reign. In fact, he was also by Nero's side when the emperor died. After Nero's death, Sporus was used by several different figures who were vying for power in the vacuum left behind. In order to avoid being further abused and presented as a piece of entertainment, Sporus killed himself in 69 CE. So the question I have is, how serious were these marriages Nero had with Pythagoras and Sporus? I think with the latter, Nero actually had some sort of messed up idea of love floating around in his skull when he married Sporus. The constant comparisons with Poppaea certainly add something to the equation. But with Pythagoras, I just don't know. The pair were married during the Feast of Saturnalia, a feast where things in Rome got a bit topsy-turvy. Gambling was openly permitted, gag gifts were exchanged, and masters provided feasts for their slaves. Was the marriage with Pythagoras just a massive Saturnalia joke? Did the marriage last longer than just the festival? It would certainly explain why he just disappears outside of that story. But yeah, that's it for the spouses of Nero. And weirdly enough, marrying a slave who looked like his dead wife is just the tip of the Nero weirdness iceberg. So let's keep looking at some of the more wacky misadventures Nero forced on Rome during his rule. As you might have heard, there's a famous expression, "Nero fiddled while Rome burned." Well, I debunked that phrase back in episode 11 of the show for a couple reasons. One, that probably never happened. And for the oddly important reason number two, Nero didn't play the fiddle. In fact, the fiddle wouldn't exist until almost a millennia after Nero's own life. He did, however, play the kithara, which is an instrument closely related to the lute, so a stringed instrument like a small harp. He was also apparently into singing as well. I can't say for certain how good he was at either the kithara or singing, but apparently Nero loved both forms of art. And apparently, he was way too into music. It's said that his love of music was beyond that which was socially acceptable for a Roman noble of this time. So clearly, we're in a different time period from Frederick the Great composing music for the flute and Bill Clinton jamming out on the saxophone. There are stories, though how much truth behind them is uncertain, that Nero would sometimes hold massive solo concerts at theaters and keep the doors locked until he had completed his set list. There are similar stories that he would also do this at parties, locking people in until he'd had his fun with whatever was on the menu for that evening, be it music, food, or other forms of debauchery. Roman historian Suetonius wrote that Nero was acclaimed as the equal of Apollo in music and of the sun in driving a chariot. He had planned to emulate the exploits of Hercules as well. Yeah, because if you're so good at music, might as well show that you're also a massive jock as well. In order to show off some of that, in 60 CE, Nero created the Neronian Games. These were somewhat based off the Greek Olympic Games, but with the Nero twist of including both arts and athletics. The games were divided into three sections. The first section included performances dedicated to music, oration skills, and poetic readings. The second section was a gymnastics competition. The third section was all about equestrianism, horse riding. And of course, you know that Nero had to get in on his own games. He was voted as the victor for the oration round. Now, it should be noted that the judges were ex-consuls, aka people who really wanted to be on Nero's good side. Would regular citizens not have voted for him? I mean, they probably still would have. He was the emperor after all. Nero was also voted as the victor for the music round for his lyre playing, though he refused to accept his victory medal and instead offered it to a statue of Augustus. Suetonius then says that before his participation in the gymnastics portion of the Neronian Games, he shaved his first beard to the accompaniment of a splendid sacrifice of bullocks, which, I mean, I don't know what to say about that. Also, he was 23 at those games. How long was his first beard? Anyways, the games were decreed to be held every 5 years. They would once again be held in 65 CE. There would be no third outing for the Neronian Games due to Nero being dead in 70 CE. And of course, Nero would go on to participate in the Olympic Games themselves. While on a tour of Greece from 66 to 67 CE, Nero ordered that the games be held to coincide with his visit, disrupting the usual 4-year cycle of the festival. Also, he arrived at the Greek city of Olympia with massive fanfare. Now, the Olympics were actually a festival to the god Zeus, so contestants were expected to act a bit humble, even when they were massive local celebrities of their own time. Nero decided to make the games all about himself. Go figure. Like his Neronian games, Nero decided to add contests of art and music. And just like his games, Nero was crowned the victor in every competition he participated in, even when he fell out of his chariot in a race and clearly lost that race. After Nero's death, however, all of his victories would be voided. Like his predecessors, Nero also had to deal with foreign affairs, aka war. One of the most famous altercations during Nero's reign was the uprising in Roman Britain in 59 CE by the Celtic queen Boudica. Unfortunately, I do have a plan to do an entire episode about her in the future, so we'll only be briefly getting into that here so as not to spoil that episode whenever it comes. Boudica's revolt was one of the most brutal conflicts within the empire's borders during the first century. It got so bad that Nero almost considered ditching the island province altogether to avoid further conflicts with the Celtic tribes of Britannia. In the aftermath of the fighting, Nero took advice to replace the previous hardline governor of Britannia with someone a bit more lenient towards the local population. Around the same time as Boudica's revolt, Rome was also dealing with problems out east with the Parthian Empire, the latest iteration of the Persian Empire. In between the official borders of Rome and the Parthian Empire sat Armenia. Now, Armenia was technically a client kingdom of Rome, but that didn't change the fact that Parthia was right there and would rather be calling the shots. Shortly before Nero was crowned as emperor, the Parthians decided to put their own candidate on the throne in Armenia. The Romans and the Parthians had not had a major showdown since before Augustus was made emperor over 70 years before this point in time. But when Nero became emperor, he decided it was as good a time as ever to reassert Roman rule in the region. In 58 CE, Nero appointed a man named Domitius Corbulo, a former general on the German front, as the supreme military commander in the eastern provinces of Rome. After several grueling years, during which Nero himself was unaware of how bad things were actually going for his army, Parthia was weakened by internal revolts. Rome was able to once more put the war in their favor, but they never truly ended up with a solid victory. The war ended in 63 CE with Armenia put in a strange position. The Parthians would still get to have their candidate on the throne, and they would get to choose any future candidate for king of Armenia. However, Nero and the future Roman emperors after him would get to approve that choice. This had been a set of terms Nero had set up early enough in the war, it just took a while for the Parthians to agree to it. When the war actually ended, Corbulo led King Tiridates, the candidate chosen by the Parthians, to a Roman camp where he placed his crown at the feet of a statue to Nero. In 66, Tiridates traveled to Italy, where he was crowned by Nero. In his ceremony, Tiridates referred to Nero as Mithras, a name associated with the god of Zoroastrianism. Not unlike his uncle Gaius Germanicus, I'm sure it pleased Nero to be compared to a god. The final war that would shake the empire during Nero's reign was the First Jewish-Roman War. For decades now, the Jewish population of Judea was unhappy with Roman rule. Things further escalated after Nero appointed Gessius Florus as the governor of the province, the same man I mentioned earlier who may have been suggested by his wife Poppaea. Nero apparently ordered Florus to squeeze as much money from the temple in Jerusalem as was possible. Further discriminations and perceived blasphemies resulted in several large-scale revolts, which eventually coalesced into an all-out war. In 67 CE, Nero recruited a general named Vespasian, that same guy who would eventually become emperor and build the Colosseum, to lead the Roman forces in Judea. Now, there's a lot more that could be discussed with the First Jewish-Roman War as a whole, but this is an episode about Nero, and the war would continue past Nero's own death. The one note I'll add is that in 70 CE, Vespasian's son Titus would take control of the city of Jerusalem and destroy the temple there. This is remembered in Judaism as the Tisha B'Av, a day of fasting and remembrance. But successes abroad aside, Nero was not a man of war. He was the least warrior-coded emperor so far. Heck, Caligula's nickname was due to him wearing a soldier's uniform as a toddler, and he bailed on an invasion into Britain, and he was still more of a soldier than Nero. So maybe it was best that he let others wage war. But nonetheless, Nero's victories against his neighbors, and own subjects, was not enough to keep himself safe within Rome itself. After the Great Fire, Nero enacted all sorts of tax programs in order to rebuild the capital of the Roman Empire. As to be expected in times of massive tax hikes, this was very much not popular, especially among the governors of the other provinces. After all, why should they be forced to pay more for construction that didn't even affect them? And I'm just saying that to give you their position, you should maybe care about other people even if you never see them. Yes, that includes paying taxes to support people you never see. With no sign of taxes loosening up as Nero continued to build the Domus Aurea, it was only a matter of time before people started revolting. And in March of 68 CE, revolution finally came knocking on Nero's door when the governor of Central Gaul raised an army and called for a new emperor to be crowned. But that will be a story for another time. And when we visit the Julio-Claudian saga next, it will be for the last time as we figure out how the dynasty dies, bringing Rome into a new era. But for now, that's it for this week's episode of Royally Screwed. I hope you enjoyed the journey. Be sure to subscribe to the show and tell a friend all about it. The show is going on my mandatory 1 month break, but I hope you'll continue to listen when we come back. Also, leave a review on your platform of choice if you're up to that sort of thing. It helps other people find the show. When the show does return, we'll be talking about Mansa Musa, a ruler of the Mali Empire who may have just been the richest man in history. I hope you'll join me then for another topsy-turvy look into history's most interesting rulers.